Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. For decades, I've been preaching about the importance of a regimen of basic supplements that everyone should consider part of their daily health routine. So I came up with an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the intelligent medicine lifestyle. The very same supplements I take myself and prescribe for my patients. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com and check out my Intelligent Medicine Starter Kit. It's a short list of the basic supplements that I recommend as a starting point for those looking to take control of their health. They're the essential elements of a basic program that everyone could benefit from. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Our guest is Dr. Linda Isaacs. For many years, she worked together with her colleague, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who recently passed away, unfortunately. But she is continuing to offer innovative cancer therapy along the lines that she and Dr. Gonzalez developed over many years of practice. She's here to tell us a little bit about this paradigm. Just for listeners who might be interested, you have a website, and that is, What is the website again, please?
Yes, it's drlindai.com. So that's drlindai.com.
Okay. drlindai.com. You have a practice, here in Manhattan, where you see not exclusively patients with cancer, but patients of all kinds with challenging medical issues. And could you give out the information for that, please?
Sure. I'm located, as you said, in Manhattan, a few blocks from the Empire State Building. And I do see patients with all types of conditions. But what we do ask before we set up any kind of appointments is that people send in some information about themselves. As was mentioned in the first part of the interview, we do screen patients. Just be sure that they know what they're getting into and that there's a reasonable chance that I think I can be of help. So I do suggest that people go to my website and look up the section called For New Patients, where they'll find out what they would need to send in. I also have an article there that talks about the whole decision-making process about whether or not to go with an alternative cancer treatment. And I've had some patients tell me that it was helpful. So that's something that your listeners can go and look at as well.
And that's an excellent article, and I have it open in front of me, entitled Deciding Whether to Pursue an Alternative Cancer Therapy. And this is a really big deal because patients are, they're literally caught in the crosshairs. It's difficult for patients to take the leap to alternative cancer care, especially when conventional medicine sometimes offers promise. There's a lot of pressure to conform. There's also, frankly, a lot of prejudice against doctors like Dr. Gonzalez and yourself who offer alternative cancer care. I mean, the word that comes to mind is cancer quackery. There's a real visceral reaction to the notion that natural therapies may play any role whatsoever in helping to resolve cancer. So what are some of the key points in your article deciding whether to pursue an alternative cancer therapy?
Well, the first and most important point is simply to understand what you have or what the patient has. In other words, the patient needs to understand what's going on and what standard treatment can actually offer them. And sometimes you have to ask a lot of questions. You know, for instance, I think of a sad story from a few years ago, Joe Paterno, remember the Penn State coach, who was diagnosed with lung cancer right about the time that horrible scandal broke there. And I remember his family putting something out in the news that they said that the doctors have told us that the cancer is treatable. Well, sure, it's treatable. Anything can be treated. But when you use the word treatable, that doesn't mean it's curable.
It's kind of a weasel word for you're probably going to die anyway, but we can treat you.
Well, exactly. And even patients frequently hear what they want to hear. You have to ask questions. And, you know, Mr. Paterno died pretty much on schedule. So, you know, things were, as I said, treatable. I'm sure he got treatment, but it really didn't do that much for him. And so, you know, I can't tell you how frustrating it can be sometimes when, you know, we get applications from patients who have gone through a series of chemotherapy agents that, you know, aren't going to cure them. And at the end of it all, they seek out an alternative therapy, and they're giving us the third degree about whether or not what we do can possibly work for them. Right. And meanwhile, they've already gotten a bunch of treatments that don't work. Work very well.
And worse, they may deprive them of the resilience and immune stamina to benefit from an alternative therapy. So I know that in talking to Dr. Gonzalez in the past, he sometimes was reluctant to treat these overtreated patients and just had to tell them, I'm sorry, this, we're not likely, you know, once you've exhausted all conventional options, this alternative is not necessarily going to bring you back from the brink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first thing that I would say for a patient is you need to understand what you have. And, you know, sometimes that means asking questions, a lot of questions. Sometimes it means going to the internet and finding out what you can find out. You know, a lot of the patients that we see here are actually more up to date on their cancer than many doctors and even probably most oncologists. I can think of a patient right now who has multiple myeloma, and she is an absolute whiz at what drugs are out there and what they can do, and she knows the score. So a patient needs to understand what their problem is. And then after that, you know, my own take on it is if standard treatment can help you, great, go get it. Hodgkin's disease, for example, testicular cancer, localized breast or colon cancer. I believe that, you know, if things can be cured by surgery, by all means, that's certainly what I would do. So people need to understand what they have and what the options are with standard treatment. After that, you know, when you're starting to look at alternative therapies, to a large extent, you have to go with what makes sense to you, because nobody's going to have extensive data. Because statistics, as they're generated in the medical world, you know, for instance, they can quote you the statistics for how well chemo is going to work with Hodgkin's disease. Those types of studies takes huge research studies with many, many patients to generate that kind of data. And nobody in the alternative world is going to be able to produce that. What we are able to produce are case reports, you know, stories of individual patients that have done extremely well. And, you know, from my point of view, that shows what's possible with this kind of a treatment. But it's hard to do a major study with this kind of work, partly because of funding and et cetera, but also because, you know, people are not mice. They don't always follow through with treatments. You know, we've had, you know, as people can find out if they read more about us, we tried our best to do those types of research studies. But it's not as easy as it sounds, let me put it that way, and it doesn't sound easy in the first place. So, you know, again, we have Dr. Gonzalez and I wrote an article about statistics, which that link is available from my website, talking about, you know, how you're not going to be able to find that. So, you know, if you're in a situation where orthodox medicine doesn't offer a cure, well, then you may want to investigate alternatives. But just bear in mind that under those circumstances, you're going to have to do what makes sense to you, what sounds like a reasonable plan. You're not going to find a sign saying, you know, go this way. This mm-hmm. is definitely what you should do. And, you know, from my point of view, if somebody is asking me, to, in effect, persuade them to do this kind of a treatment, that's not really something I think is a good idea for me to do, because I feel like if what I have on the website, if the case reports we have available don't make sense to somebody or aren't enough for that person, then they're not too likely to stick with the treatment well enough for it to work for them. You know, I can't move in with them and talk them into taking their supplements mm-hmm. every day. So, you know, it's just something to think about, because whatever you do, whatever approach people take, I would say do it 100%. So whatever route makes sense to you, do it 100%. You know, try not to keep looking back, trying to decide what you should right. have done, because you can't go back and fix it.
Well, Dr. Bernie Siegel, who's well known to you, has coined a term, the exceptional cancer patient, the ECP. And I think that that's, to some extent, what's required to go through this rigorous program, because it does involve a lot of commitment. It does involve detoxification procedures, very strict diet, shopping for, clean, natural foods that are organic. I used to meet Dr. Gonzalez himself in the street on his way back from Whole Foods, getting his grass-fed mm-hmm. beef and his organic right. vegetables, because he was very committed to that lifestyle himself. And mm-hmm. he himself, engaged in the detoxification procedures, which are time-consuming. It does require, I think, a certain degree of a fortitude and commitment. So talk to us about the coffee enema, because that is for some people, that is really a stopper, because it sounds so counter to the way that conventional medicine thinks about cancer. And there's a science to it. It's the science behind and the plausibility of a coffee enema, putting coffee up your rectum. You know, how could that possibly have an impact on, anything whatsoever, except to maybe give you a little bit of a caffeine high?
Well, I can tell you that it's not a caffeine high, because I have, remember back in my internship when I was getting up early before I would go into the hospital to doing my coffee enemas. But the nights that I was on call and stuck in the hospital well into the next day, I wouldn't have that coffee enema available. And so I would start to feel the crummy feelings that the coffee enema relieved. And I would try drinking coffee to see if that could give me the same effect. And it did not. Anyone that's been a coffee drinker and then done coffee enemas can tell you the way you feel afterward is very different. Mm-hmm. Coffee enemas are actually rather relaxing. So the way that coffee enemas work, we believe, is that things in the coffee get, including the caffeine, get absorbed across the wall of the intestine and get into the bloodstream around the colon. And from there, they go up through the blood supply that goes straight up to the liver. There, they can help to open up the bile duct so that things flow more freely from the liver. And it also can stimulate the gallbladder to empty out, which helps get rid of waste from the liver. So that's some of the theory behind how coffee enemas might work. On a practical level, though, they've been in the medical literature for at least 150 years. I actually did a little research on this a few years ago, because I wrote a short article, which is on my website, about detoxification. And I found some references from the late 1800s where people were using coffee enemas for detoxification of people that had been poisoned. Like, for instance, I remember one about a child, as I recall, who had ingested some toxic substance, and they used coffee enemas and felt that that helped the child recover faster. I also found an article that was describing a lecture that one of the Mayo brothers, who founded the Mayo Clinics, he was talking about post-operative care, and he said that an absolutely critical, essential part of post-operative care was a coffee enema. So they've been in the literature for a while. We also have another article. It's really wild, actually. It's a doctor in Uruguay who used coffee enemas in the treatment of sepsis of various kinds, and described really remarkable turnarounds. Now, this is in the pre-antibiotic era, when people that were septic, it was typically an infectious issue. And he was turning people around with septic shock that with coffee enemas. So it's one of those techniques that, you know, bit by bit just came to be seen as unscientific and blah de blah. But I don't think anybody's ever done any kind of study to prove it to be harmful in any way. And I can tell you that we have a lot of patients who swear by them. So they're perfectly safe when done as directed. Certainly there's a few articles out there where people decided to use boiling hot coffee straight out of the coffee pot to do the coffee enemas, which anyone with any common sense wouldn't do that. But overall, they're extremely safe.
And there actually are some recent articles which vindicate coffee. Coffee was used to be something that you had to kick the coffee habit to be healthier. But actually, many studies now suggest that high coffee consumers, the oral route, that is, may enjoy a reduced risk of hepatocellular carcinoma and cirrhosis. Mm-hmm. And so there clearly may be some physiological benefits coffee by whatever route, but in particular, you know, you may accentuate the benefits via coffee enema and that detox that more facilitates than just taking it for the oral route. So let's talk a little bit about successes. Now, Dr. Gonzalez, presumably with support from you, has undertaken studies, case studies, published case studies, entered into an unfortunate trial with Columbia, where, you know, he wrote a very, very long book describing his disillusionment with the conventional research paradigm because he really felt betrayed by some of the corners that were cut and, frankly, some of the biases that were introduced when they studied his methodology. So he was always seeking vindication. He wasn't just trying to practice in the shadows. He was trying to prove via scientific studies that his methodology worked. But so what are some of the outstanding successes that you see?
Well, what I thought, we have some case histories that have been published in the past, and I know that, you know, at the time of his death, Dr. Gonzalez was working on a large case book, which would compile a number of those cases into a manuscript form. And that is, you know, being worked on, by his wife and a medical editor to hopefully bring that to conclusion.
Right.
But, we had published an article in January of 2007, which included, I believe it was a total of 36 cases. And one of them, a patient of mine, she had first started feeling poorly in November of 2000. She had some intestinal upset and had lost some weight. And I've always given a lot of credit to her doctor. Intestinal upset, many times people are just sent on their way with a prescription for, you know, an acid blocker and that's it. But because of her weight loss, her physician's ears went up and she sent her off for a CAT scan, which showed a 3.4 centimeter mass in the head of the pancreas. Mm-hmm. That would be a little over an inch, I guess, inch and a half. And so she then had a needle biopsy. They took some cells out of it and took a look and described it as a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. That's the nasty kind of pancreatic cancer. Mm-hmm. And they had the slides read at the Mayo Clinic as well. So two different groups of doctors agreed that she had the nasty kind of pancreatic cancer. Now, she had actually applied for that study that was being run at Columbia, and she sent all her records. They looked them over and told her to get on a plane and fly to New York because it looked like she would be eligible. And then when she got to Columbia, looking at the exact same records that she had sent originally, they asked her, well, why aren't you going to be getting surgery for this pancreatic tumor? And she said, well, I'm choosing not to get it.
Right.
And they said, but then you're not eligible for the study. Mm-hmm. And so she showed up to my office later that day in tears because she thought that meant that I wouldn't treat her. Now, with some types of cancer, you know, with surgery being a curative possibility, I would say go get it. But pancreatic, you know, the success rate for that's only about 25%. And in other words, even if you think you've, quote, got it all, you know, 3/4 of patients will wind up having a recurrence. And then you throw in that it is a major, major operation. And she had already told 3 different groups of doctors that she wasn't going to get the surgery. So I went ahead and treated her off the Columbia protocol. And on the treatment, she is still alive and doing well. And she called me. We spoke several times last fall. She actually called just because she was worried about me after Dr. Gonzalez passed right. away. And she called with her condolences and offers of support. So she is
how many years?
This would put her 15, 16 years out right. with a diagnosis that should have killed her in 15 or 16 months.
Right.
That would have been an optimistic forecast for the type of cancer that she had. So, you know, she's the kind of patient that keeps us going, keeps us doing what we're doing, because I truly believe that without this program and without her hard work on this program, she would no longer be with us.
Indeed. So if pancreatic cancer was always a type of cancer that I know Dr. Gonzalez was very happy to treat, because that was a cancer that was very amenable to his methodology. Any other types of cancer do you find are particularly suitable for this?
It's really more about the patient with the problem as opposed to okay. the problem itself. We believe that pancreatic enzymes can potentially treat any kind of cancer. So what we're more looking for is the type of patient that can and will follow through.
Okay. So it's about commitment. It's about the stage of the cancer. It's about, again, the suitability of the type of cancer. And I think people can learn more about that, by first scoping out your website, but then, you know, perhaps, having some initial contact with your office to see if they're eligible for this type of treatment.
Right.
So to sum up, where do you think this is going? It's a very unique type of treatment. Do you think that this treatment will stand the test of time, or do you think it's going to be supplanted by better, more effective conventional treatments of cancer, and eventually it'll be sort of a historical aberration? Some people think, oh, you know, we're doing a moon launch to try a moonshot to try and finally overcome cancer. We've spent literally billions and billions of dollars on cancer research. Eventually we're going to come up with an answer, and then these therapies may drop by the wayside. Do you see that as being a possibility?
Well, I don't really know, and I certainly hope that regardless of how we get there, that 30 years from now, cancer will be something that's much more manageable than it is now. On a practical level, though, I do believe that some components of what we do, like, for instance, the idea that different diets are good for different people, I think that may be something that will come into the mainstream fairly soon. I think even some of the studies have been done on different diets for weight loss, and the realization that the Atkins diet does not make cholesterol go through the roof. You know, those kinds of things are seeping into the mainstream. And so those concepts may become more generally accepted. But I also think that many of the wonderful breakthrough things that we hear about on the news from the conventional world for cancer are being seriously overhyped. And mm-hmm. so at any given time, there's going to be some magical thing that's going to make all the difference. But then the reality turns out to be something less than that. So even some of the new immunotherapies, I mean, those things can be incredibly toxic, and you know, people go through quite a lot with those treatments, and you know, I don't know whether they're going to pan out or not, but I do feel like, you know, whatever works. I don't think that this work is going to turn into a, you know, historical oddity, but I can't predict the future. I know that what I want to do is just continue to collect these case reports and continue to treat the people that can truly benefit from what I have to offer.
Well, yeah, I personally want to salute you for your very innovative work and for your steadfast adherence to principles which are which are not always acknowledged as being the right way to go, clearly lying outside the conventional mainstream. So once again, our intelligent medicine call to action for today, check out the website. It's drlindai.com, correct?
That's right. Uh-huh.
And there are books as well, if you want to tackle books. Can you mention some of those?
Sure. The one that I co-authored, The Trophoblast and the Origins of Cancer, describes the theoretical reasons why pancreatic enzymes can be effective against cancer. Dr. Gonzalez's book about his research on Dr. Kelly is in the book One Man Alone. And there are also, well, there's his book about the clinical trial, What Went Wrong. And then there are also some recordings available of Dr. Gonzalez giving speeches on different topics. There are also some recordings of me on my own website. The books and recordings for Dr. Gonzalez and myself, in the case of the Trophoblast, are available from the publisher, which is New Spring Press, newspringpress.com, or you can find them on Amazon.
Great work. I want to salute you. Thank you so much for joining us. It's very informative. I appreciate it very much. Dr. Linda Isaacs. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.